Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Listen Up with Jim Potts, only on LA Talk Radio.
Jim Potts back on the air. As always, thank you so much for joining me on your Sunday evening. I really appreciate that. Well, today we've got some interesting information for you. We've got the Honorable Steve Cooley, the former LA County District Attorney, is going to be here with us today to share some information. He's got a couple of books that we're going to be talking about. The first one is called Blue Lives Matter in the Line of Duty. And he's got a second one getting ready to come out. And that's going to be exciting as well. I'll let you talk to him about that one. That one's called Blue Lives in Jeopardy, When the Badge Becomes a Target. Very interesting for sure. Steve, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Doing great, Jim. Thank you.
I appreciate you being here today. I want to send a shout out real quick, Steve, to letting everybody know this is National Police Week. I think, you know, my listeners have heard me speak about the police officers in the past. When police officers get killed in the line of duty, I've mentioned it on the show. The total right now is about 40 police officers that have been killed this year, 16 killed by gunfire, unfortunately. So, Steve, I want to start out by asking you some questions, if you don't mind.
All right.
First of all, the concept of Blue Lives Matter, I mean, we hear a lot about Black Lives Matter. What is this concept of blue lives? Could you explain that for us?
Blue lives has been a term used to essentially identify law enforcement officers and their causes over the years. There are numerous blue lives groups, foundations, and organizations, particularly on the East Coast, many of which were formed to raise money and support survivors of law enforcement officers killed or injured in the line of duty. So that's been around 30 or 40 years.
Oh, really?
Okay. There's also a Blue Lives radio station based out of Nevada, which daily discusses law enforcement issues. So the concept Blue Lives is essentially shorthand for police officers and law enforcement.
Very good. Before I forget, listeners, just in the event anybody wants to call in as we move along and have any questions for Steve, you can call in at 818-602-4929, 818-602-4929. And as always, if you want to send me an email, listenupwithjp@pottsassociates.com. That's listenupwithjp@pottsassociates.com. Now, if you want to get on my email blast on my blog about the upcoming show topics, just text Potts Associates and text that to 22828. Again, text that to Potts Associates, 22828. All right. Well, Steve, if you don't mind, let me start off by asking you some questions, actually. Can you give us a brief history of your career before becoming the district attorney?
Yeah, it's pretty straightforward. I attended Cal State Los Angeles, and then I matriculated at USC Law Center. While at USC, I joined the Los Angeles Police Department Reserve Program, went through their academy, and served as reserve officer for nearly 7 years. After law school, I joined the Los Angeles County DA's office 2 weeks after taking the bar exam, and I joined as a law clerk and stayed there for 39 and a half years, rising from law clerk all the way to being the three-term elected district attorney. I served as DA from 2000 to 2012. I retired on 11:59 a.m. on December the 4th, 2012, and handed over the keys to my car in the office to Jackie Lacey, who's the current DA.
Okay, very good. Do you miss it?
I miss a lot of the people and some of the action and the decision-making and the ability and being in the position to do the right thing according to the law and according to the facts.
Okay. All right. Well, then let me ask you, what do you remember was the toughest part of your job as district attorney?
I think the toughest part of that job, maybe any job, is making sure you're putting the right people in the right places. The Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office has over 1,000 prosecutors.
Wow.
300 peace officer investigators, 700 clerical, technical, and support staff. It's a big operation. as the person who puts people in various positions, whether it be pursuing public corruption, handling frauds, handling line operations. It's up to you to pick the best person to optimize that aspect of the agency. If you don't do that, and I've made a few mistakes, then you pay that price. So picking the right people and avoiding picking the wrong people, that's probably the biggest challenge in any organization, because you as an individual are not going to be making all the decisions, the hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of daily decisions to make sure justice, accurate justice, is achieved by that office.
So would you, part of your job be, if you had a, if you had, did you assign cases as well?
I was involved as district attorney. I certainly was consulted about who might be on a particular high-profile case. But generally, I left that to high-level managers because they knew what the calendars were, who was the best fit. They were closer to the action to make that decision. Of course, I would make the decision as to who was who in which position.
Right.
And they'd be making decisions about literally hundreds of thousands of cases each year. The back when I was the DA, they filed 65,000 felonies a year,
wow.
Probably declined three times that many felonies, and then filed 250,000 misdemeanors and probably declined a couple hundred thousand misdemeanor cases. So there's really hundreds of thousands of cases about which there are dozens or more decisions made in each case. And that's why you need talented people, dedicated people, honest people to make those decisions, whether it be a driving under the influence or a serial murderer.
Is it true? Isn't the L.A. County District Attorney's Office one of the highest in the country in terms of the amount of, excuse the expression, action or the amount of cases that are presented?
Well, it is absolutely the largest local prosecutorial agency in the United States of America. The only one, well, the one that comes second is Cook County, which is essentially Chicago.
Right.
And they're about half the size in terms of volume of work of the Los Angeles County DA's office. Remember, Los Angeles County has a population of nearly 11 million people.
Wow, right.
And the district attorney's office handles all the felonies in Los Angeles County and misdemeanor filings for 78 of the 88 cities in Los Angeles County, the major exception being Los Angeles City and Long Beach and a few others. And then they handle all the misdemeanor prosecutions in the unincorporated portions of Los Angeles County, which is about one-third of Los Angeles County's square miles. So it's a big area, a lot of people, and a lot of work.
So that means you're working with a lot of different law enforcement agencies also. I mean, I was with the Sheriff's Department, as you know, and then you had LAPD, and then you had some of the local ones also.
Well, the way it roughly breaks down is the Los Angeles Police Department polices about one-third of the citizens within the county in L.A. City. The Sheriff's Department polices through contract cities and unincorporated parts of the county about one-third of the population in the county, and a huge area geographically. And the other one-third of the residents receive policing from about 45 local police agencies, some very small and some relatively large.
Okay. Well, let me ask you, what major case would you say you remember the most throughout that 39-year career?
Well,
pick one out.
As the district attorney, the case that I feel very strongly about because it had such a great impact on the criminal justice system was the Grim Sleeper case.
Oh, yeah.
As you probably recall, the Grim Sleeper strangled, raped, murdered a number of women in the South Central area over the years up until the mid-80s. And then there was no further contact. Law enforcement knew it was the same person based upon case-to-case hits on DNA. They knew it was the same assailant. And then the same assailant appeared again, early 2000s, and he was dubbed the Grim Sleeper by a local newspaper reporter because he woke up and started committing the same acts. So there was a tremendous concern in the South Central community because of they knew it was the same person. It was a lot of young women were being murdered brutally, and something had to be done. So the Los Angeles Police Department, working with my office, some of my very skilled prosecutors, advanced the cause of using what is called partial match familial DNA to identify the then unknown assailant. Partial match familial DNA basically is you submit an unknown assailant's profile against the state's DNA database of convicted felons and see if there's another DNA profile in there that's close to this unknown assailant.
Oh, I know where you're
that's
going
the
with
partial
that.
Match.
Right.
And then you go, okay, we got a partial match here. Well, they submitted it. This is after a great deal of lobbying Governor Brown and others by my office to use this technique. And then they do what they call a familial search. Okay, who in this convicted felon's family is the right age to have committed these offenses? And then we'll get his DNA. Well, it was Lonnie Franklin Jr., was the father of a young man who was his DNA was taken, and it was in the database. They go, well, he couldn't have done it because he wasn't old enough to rape and murder anyone back in the late 80s. Has to be someone close to him. Well, the father, Lonnie Franklin Jr., was the right age to have committed the crimes back in the 80s and in the early 2000s. And so they did that. Then LAPD watched Mr. Franklin. He went out to get some pizza. A police officer posing as a waiter came up, picked up his fork, his pizza, his plate, his cup. They rushed it down, tested it.
Right.
Boom, it was him.
That was it.
And then on July 4th, 2010, I remember spending several hours in my backyard on a teleconference with two or three deputy DAs, a guy named Pat Dixon, who was the head deputy of major crimes, and we were writing the search warrant for Lonnie Franklin's house. I want to get involved in the search warrant in that case because I wanted to get the word out about this technique and
yeah,
how important it was.
Right.
And so it was, anyway, he was arrested, and then they went to his house, did a search. They got the murder weapon. They got the photos. They got everything. And,
wow.
You know, he was convicted
right.
and got 11 death penalty verdicts. And he's still suspected of having strangled, murdered maybe another dozen or two dozen women.
Was he ever executed?
No, he just got convicted a couple of years ago. It takes like 40 years to get executed
well,
in California.
Yeah, you're right. Now with the current governor.
Then we have Governor Newsom giving a moratorium to people like the Grim Sleeper. No. I would not bet on his execution.
Right, you're right. Yeah.
But that was the law, and we followed the law.
Right.
And the jurors did, and that's the important thing.
Yeah, no, the criminal techniques that law enforcement has developed over the years is incredible. The DNA thing, well, you know, the DNA thing is good also because innocent people have gotten out of jail.
Absolutely.
That were convicted, so.
Oh, there's a lot of exoneration behind DNA. As a matter of fact, there were people who were possible suspects or people of interest in the Grim Sleeper case, and they gave their DNA up. But not you. And so, no, it's a great tool.
Right. You know, that's very good. Because fingerprints was the big deal before that, I guess.
Fingerprints also advanced incredibly in the last decade or so. And a lot of this ability to use these scientific breakthroughs is a result of computers' capacity to aggregate huge amounts of information and analyze them. And we've had some success with the system called AFIS, Automated Fingerprint Index System, which is essentially the same thing as doing a DNA profile, except a computer does the analysis, and it does it in a nanosecond, and it does it against an information database that's huge. In AFIS, the Automated Fingerprint Index System, there are 50 years every single law enforcement agencies arrest all 50 states all in one database.
Wow.
That could be compared against instantly.
That's incredible.
It is incredible.
You know, I don't know how criminals sometimes think they can get away with things these days. It's beyond me because the technology.
Don't leave any DNA and don't leave your fingerprints, I guess. Wear a mask.
Yeah, but they also got cameras these days also.
Wear a mask.
Hey, if anybody has any questions, once again, I always encourage people at 1-818-602-4929. So that's 818-602-4929. That was very interesting. I appreciated that. Let me ask you a question. I understand that you've written a book. Why don't you tell us why you decided to write a book, first of all?
Well, my co-author, Bob Schoen, was the office's longtime historian. And over the years, he had archived a lot of information about a lot of the interesting cases the DA's office had dealt with or prosecuted over the years. And we fiddled around with some other topics like celebrity justice, because LA's kind of known for that. And then we redounded to writing about something that we knew we could get the information from DA files and court records, and where we could get anecdotal input from the people who handled the cases, the judges, the prosecutors, next of kin, and others. And we thought, okay, it would be a good idea to memorialize the murders of law enforcement officers, kind of honor them. And this is a nonfiction book, and these are some of the more notorious murders of police officers. The unfortunate thing, we had literally scores and scores to pick from. So we wrote our first book, Blue Lives Matter in the Line of Duty. You can find it or check it out on bluelivesmatterbook.com. And that was very well received, particularly by law enforcement, because we took the facts as we assembled them and wrote each chapter, and then gave it over to an individual, a nationally renowned use of force police tactics expert called Greg Meyer, retired LAPD captain. And he analyzed what we wrote, and then we would include a lessons learned component demonstrate what went wrong. So other law enforcement officers now and in the future can read the book and go, okay, I'm not going to make that mistake.
Right.
Or I'm going to have a better tactic. Or I'm not going to put myself in harm's way. I'm going to avoid that. And in each of the chapters, there's a lessons learned component. For example, chapter 7, of our first book, The Murder of Captain Michael Sparks, LA County Police, the title is Know Where You Are. He didn't know where he was, and he was unable to give his location when he's being robbed and shot with an AK-47. It was all, by the way, it was all captured on his cell phone. But he didn't know where he was.
You mean where his physical location was at the time?
Yeah, he was out riding his bike, trying to shed a few pounds. Early morning exercise, and some gangbangers decided to rob him, and they shot him up with their AK-47.
They obviously did not know who he was, so it wasn't planned.
No, he did identify himself as a law enforcement officer with his badge
right.
during the course of the robbery, mm-hmm. but it wasn't like this is, oh, it must be a cop, let's go kill him. It was Joe Citizen, let's go kill him
right.
and rob him. Other chapters all have a message of what not to do. The Blue Lives in Jeopardy, our second book, actually is even more instructive in terms of the lessons learned component, in terms of what went wrong. And lessons there are obvious. Sometimes you got to take a partner. Other times you got to call in your location when you're making a traffic stop. Sometimes before you confront a group of what appear to be gang members, call for backup. There's just lessons learned. And I think that the dramatic nature of the stories we tell will have an impact on law enforcement officers currently on the job, those in the academies, those who want to go into that profession, They should read it because it will impact them and they'll remember.
Well, they got criminal justice programs out there also with some of the colleges.
This right. Just yesterday I was invited by a friend of mine named Walt Allen, whom you may know. He's the head of the Rio Hondo Police Academy, and he's invited Bob Schrin and myself out to lecture because he thought it would be very impactful for those recruits to hear it, straight from the horse's mouth, so to speak, and have that drilled home. And we hope those out there in the police training arena, especially at the academies, use this almost as a textbook.
Well, you went to the academy. I went. You went to Rio Hondo, I think you said.
No, I went to LAPD Academy.
Oh, sorry, LAPD. Yeah. That's right. And I went through the LA County Sheriff's Department Academy.
Right.
And you're right. I mean, they do try to talk to us about self-preservation, basically, understanding where we are at any particular time. I think one of the issues, that you might agree with me, is the fact that once you're on the job and you're doing it constantly, you get a little bit more lackadaisical maybe than you should be.
Absolutely, and that's proven out in some of our chapters. Where officers kind of let their guard down, did not follow proper procedures, and sometimes were just executed before they can get the gun out of their holster. They just made tactical mistakes because they let their guard down, and they became complacent.
You know, Steve, right now there's a big issue out there regarding police officers getting killed, as you know. Tactics or not, some of these people are just walking up and kill. I mean, the last officer that got shot 2 weeks ago, he was in the parking lot at the police station, and this guy just walks up to him and shoots him. I mean,
that's a trend. I read an article the other day. They said that is the trend in law enforcement officers being killed. There's always going to be a certain number of law enforcement officers killed in traffic accidents,
right,
fatalities, and things of that nature. However, when it comes to being shot, the trend now is officers essentially being assassinated.
Right.
That's the topic of our second book, Blue Lives in Jeopardy, when the badge becomes the target. Ambushed, essentially assassinated. We have one of our chapters in the second book is the murder of Officer Steiner, a CHP officer. He had just finished testifying about a traffic ticket. He's walking away from the courthouse, and some 15-year-old gangbanger trying to impress his fellow gang members to get in the gang just shoots him in cold blood. Assassination. So that seems to be the trend, and that's a trend not just in Los Angeles. That's in New York. That's in Washington State. That's in Las Vegas. You can see these situations where officers are just maybe having a meal. Someone comes in and shoots them. That is the trend, and it's not a good trend. Dallas, they had that thing down there.
Right.
So there's a lot of that going on.
You know, one of the things that concerns me, and I don't normally get into the politics on the show. I want to make that clear. But one of the things that does concern me is the misconception sometimes that the general public has about white officers, as an example, shooting, black citizens. So some of this supposedly is a kickback to people getting retribution because they don't feel that they're getting a fair shake. What's your opinion about that? I mean, I the other day I was doing an active shooter training at a location, and this lady said, because I told the police officers, we learn procedural things. I mean, it's almost automatic. We practice things over and over and over again. Her question to me was, well, how do you explain then, and police officers not panicking, how do you explain so many black citizens being killed by, being killed by police officers? And I explained to her, I said, look, first of all, if you look at the statistics, that number is really very small. It's the media that really blows it up.
Yeah, statistically, it's a very small number.
Right.
And you have to look at statistics in terms of the demographics and the population. How many, let's say, whites or Latinos are being shot by police officers? Well, it sort of depends upon the demographics of that particular city or community. But ultimately, it has to be the facts of the case or
right,
the circumstances that particular officer confronted at that moment. And kind of look at the demographics of law enforcement officers being killed. What were those circumstances? What mistakes did they make? So I look at each case, and then you have to have good, honest prosecutors who take a look at it, look at the provable facts in the law and decide each case on its own merits. And there have been instances in the country where law enforcement officers in uniform shoot an individual, whatever their ethnicity or background is, and they get convicted of murder,
right?
As it should be, based upon the facts and the law.
But the sad part about it is, if a white officer kills somebody under those circumstances, kills another white officer, you don't really hear about it. When it's a white officer killing a black person, then all of a sudden the media takes over, and they fan the flames with some of that.
Well, I'm not so sure it's just the media, but certain
groups also.
Certain groups in the community right. want to make it a race thing. But oftentimes it's an African-American officer has to kill a Latino suspect or whatever, or a white person.
Right.
It's the facts.
Right.
And what's right and what's wrong. And if they're wrong, prosecute them. And if they're right, reject the case and move on.
You know, unfortunately, the problem is that the everyday citizen doesn't get to see all the facts that come out when it goes to the trial. I think that's a major problem because the jury gets to hear everything.
Well, except in many of these cases, the cases are not filed by the district attorney because they decide, in the case of officer-involved shootings, they decide the officer justified, and so they reject the case. But most district attorneys, worth their salt, will publish a very comprehensive written review of the facts and the law and their conclusions. Now, those that go to trial, they're relatively seldom when it comes to officers being tried for murder of a citizen, but those do get pretty good publicity because they're so rare.
Okay, all right. Now, let me ask you a question. We were talking briefly before we got started, and one of the things that I put in my second book, Right to Counsel, I talked about the impact of the victim's family. So when you hear about these things, and you hear about these poor victims getting killed, what about the impact on the victims' families?
Well, that's a very, very good point. During my time as the district attorney, I had the opportunity, in some cases the honor, of getting to know the next of kin of victims in general in certain cases, but in a number of the murders of law enforcement officers that are detailed in the book, parents, siblings, spouses. I went to the funerals, saw the children left behind. That impact is never going to leave the next of kin, the loving family, and the friends of that officer. They're going to get up every day thinking about Deputy so-and-so or Officer so-and-so and how brutally they were murdered and maybe how it could have been avoided. We have one case that we documented where the father of the officer killed on the stand during the victim impact presentation just cries out, I wish it was me, not you, my son. It's just heartbreaking. But right. No, that's just... No, it's tough. And I think you're right. There's not enough sense of that. Now, our book brings some of that to life.
Okay.
We do deal with, talk to, and incorporate the views of some of the next of kin of the victims in the book.
So the book sounds like it's very thorough. You know, when I read the book, there was one that jumped out at me. This guy named, you might remember that case with Gerald Mason.
Yeah, Gerald Mason. Yeah, I know that case. I worked on that one, too.
Yeah, tell us about it. Because I was amazed about how they were able to actually capture him, because it had been years since he had committed. He killed two police officers, as I recall.
Right. That case, we entitled that chapter, We Do Not Forgive, We Do Not Forget, We Do Not Give Up, because Gerald Mason murdered two El Segundo police officers with a handgun in 1957. And it was like, 37 years later.
Right.
The case is reopened, and that was a fluke. someone on his deathbed says something along the lines of, I think Joe Blow killed those two El Segundo police officers way back then. Oh, really? Yeah, so they open up the file, and they find a partial fingerprint from an index finger, latent, in the file. And they said, well, you know, the guy dying was wrong, but let's take a look at this fingerprint again, given technology. So they take the partial print. It's in two parts. They computer enhance it, and they submit it to the FBI's just open, like 2 or 3 months earlier, just open automated fingerprint index system to see if they get a match, and they instantly got a match. Gerald Mason, 70-year-old, almost 70-year-old gas station owner, successful businessman, really? Now retired, right. Golfer, grandkids, whatever.
And straight-up guy at this point. Yeah,
except then they go back and they build the case. They trace his movements out to California. They gather other evidence, handwriting, ballistics. And amazingly, one of the officers had actually gotten a few rounds off, and the bullet was still lodged in Gerald Mason's back.
Really?
Yeah, that never came out in trial, because there was no trial. He pled guilty. Mm. But it was the power of that automated fingerprint index system to have 50 years worth of every person ever arrested in the United States of America by any law enforcement agency in one computer database, and then the ability to take a look at that aggregate information and discreetly pick out that one fingerprint. That's how we got Gerald Mason.
And he was in South Carolina, as I remember.
You know what? He got arrested on his birthday, his 70th birthday. And
I hope they wasn't at a party they were holding for.
No, he was. No, they went to the door, they knocked on the door, and the LA County DA's office guys were there. El Segundo PD, obviously local law enforcement,
right?
LA County sheriffs, because it was a joint El Segundo sheriff's investigation. And as they knock on the door, he comes to the door, and they say, Gerald Mason, we're here to arrest you for the murders of Officer Richard Phillips and Milton Curtis, July 22nd, 1957.
I mean, he had to be shocked.
He looks at them, and he says, are you here about that? Almost like he, you know, that's old news.
Right.
Well, it wasn't old news. He fought extradition for a while. Our office shared the evidence that we gathered. He waived extradition. He flew out to LAX, was driven to downtown criminal courts building, went to court, pled guilty, and was sentenced to two consecutive life terms in state prison.
But when I recall, they let him serve his time back in South Carolina to be closer to his family.
I think there may have been an interstate transfer, and that's not unusual. That's actually quite common.
Oh, really?
There's an interstate compact that allows for that. That makes actually sense.
Oh, yeah.
For a lot of reasons. But as long as you're locked up, you're not going anyplace.
So how old was he when he committed it? He had to be in his 20s.
I'd say 23, 24.
Right. All those years.
Yeah.
And after that, he led an upstanding life, I guess.
He worked his way back there, became a successful gas station owner, played golf, enjoyed life. Unfortunately, the two officers he killed and their next of kin did not have that same opportunity.
Yeah, I remember reading in there about how, I think it was his daughter was only 4 years old. One of the police officers, I think it was Officer
right.
Phillips, she was only like 4 years old.
Well, you'll find in our book how we detail the next of kin,
right.
and the children the officers killed. In our next book, one of the most tragic chapters is chapter one. It's called the Newhall Incident. It was the murder of four highway patrol officers. They were all married. Several of them had just infant children, and they're still suffering to this day. You know, the wives, spouses have probably passed on. But the children, they've grown up.
They're without a father.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. It's a hard impact. I know in my book, one of the, Michael D. Matson was the one who was the serial killer in my book. But he killed this young girl. She was only 9 years old. And, you know, the family members, They couldn't even talk. They couldn't even mention her name in the household.
No,
for years.
No.
I mean, you know, pictures came down. You know, they couldn't. They just couldn't deal
with it. Well, I think the way next of kin and murder victims deal with it, and not just, you know, law enforcement officers, but sexual assault murders, either they tend to, I won't say glorify, but really memorialize and remember the deceased family member, or they just try and shut it off because it's too painful. Hmm. A lot of different people, people deal with grief differently.
You know, one of the things that I've talked about on the show before, because when I do a lot of this active shooter training, I have people to ask me about CCWs. Well, Jim, should I get my CCW? That's a concealed carry permit for those listeners who do not know what that is. And I tell them stay away from it because there's a lot of responsibility with carrying a gun.
Well, California makes it really easy if you want a CCW permit. In most counties, it's virtually impossible.
Right.
They're not going to grant them. Even with good cause. Now, there, as you probably know, there's a lot of litigation going on right now,
right,
over the whether or not California's law is arbitrarily and capriciously and unconstitutionally applied by the sheriffs in California. Other states are basically, if you apply, you get one. If you're otherwise a law-abiding citizen, not a drug addict or a criminal. But California is very, very strict. I'll bet between L.A. City, which has 4.4 million people, and Los Angeles County with nearly 11 million people, I'll bet you don't have more than a couple dozen CCW permits granted to citizens. Now, you go down to Orange County, apparently they've adopted the position, according to one court case, that if you apply and you're otherwise an honorable law-abiding citizen, you get one. It really depends upon where you live.
Yeah, Ventura's kind of giving them away also.
Yeah, it depends upon their interpretation of the law, which I believe is headed towards the Supreme Court at some point, and who's in charge in the county or the city. Because the way it works is, if you live in a city, you have to apply to the chief of police of the city where you reside.
Right.
And then, if for some reason they don't grant it, then you can apply to the sheriff of the county where you reside.
Right.
And quite frankly, the fact that it's so different from, let's say, Orange County to L.A. County to Ventura County to maybe Madera County in terms of how they're being issued, that raises a constitutional question also. So it's kind of a mess just in terms of getting one. But in terms of getting one, you never know. Maybe that one good, honest citizen who's armed can stop an active shooter
situation. But you know what? But Steve, the only thing about that is that I try to explain to some of the people in his classes that, look, police officers, it's a lot for police officers in that kind of scenario to be able to draw your gun and accurately shoot a perpetrator when everybody's screaming and running around, as an example. Look what happened at the Borderline Cafe.
Oh, yeah.
There was two police officers who responded to that situation.
Yeah, deputy sheriff and a CHP officer.
And the CHP officer did what? He accidentally killed the other officer.
Well, I studied that case
quite
carefully. You're right that the CHP officer did shoot a shot that was fatal.
Right.
But the active shooter had already shot
him. Oh, yeah.
Shot that officer multiple times.
That's right.
But they were like arm wounds or thigh wounds.
Right.
And maybe not fatal wounds. But, yeah, you're right. Right. Even for law enforcement, that kind of situation has to be mind-boggling. It's just so unprecedented.
I tell them that you can't listen. You can train people to shoot a gun. You could train them to care for the weapon. It's difficult. Okay, you are a reserve police officer. People pointed guns at you like they pointed guns at me. In that particular scenario, you know, these people that are just civilians that are not used to being in that kind of situation, going to be able to carefully pull out a gun and shoot a perpetrator without their hand shaking. Without the adrenaline pumping.
I think that's a valid point.
Yeah. It's difficult.
Very, very difficult. It's difficult for law enforcement. You've seen some of the failures of law enforcement in some of these active shooter situations, and you see other situations, scenarios, where they actually rush in and do the right thing.
That's
right.
They
probably do save lives. I think the Columbine, that incident, which was celebrated, 20 years?
Right.
That proved that setting up a perimeter and bringing in all the equipment and getting your stuff on and then thinking about it and strategizing is not the way to go after active shooters, because while you're doing all that, the active shooter's killing people.
Right.
So that sort of changed the mindset for law enforcement in terms of how to respond to these situations. It's not perfect.
Right.
But I think it makes more sense in terms of the numbers of innocent lives that would otherwise be lost if you did not engage the active shooter. Now you're going to lose a few law enforcement officers who engage.
Right.
But, you know, that's the price you pay.
Well, you know, you and I were at that Police Officers Association meeting not too long ago when the FBI was there, as well as the SWAT leader, team leader that was there talking about the Las Vegas shooting.
Right.
And talking about lessons that they learned as a result of that. I mean, some of that stuff was just absolutely incredible.
I thought the way Las Vegas Metro PD, one, responded to the incident that day, which was huge in terms of the numbers of people wounded and numbers of people
right.
killed. And then their subsequent investigation, that presentation I thought was phenomenal. That's worthy of a television program.
Right.
But they learned some lessons and about, you know, remember the part about the false calls?
Oh, yeah.
People here are hearing shots all over Las Vegas, the different casinos.
20 hostages at New York.
Right. It was nutty. No, but that's the kind of training that the Peace Officers Association of Los Angeles County does. And you know who organized that was a Greg Meyer.
Is that right?
He was the MC for that event. He's the one that contributes to all of our chapters. He kept talking about our book.
That's right. Now I do recall. Matter of fact, I think that's when I got your book.
Yeah.
Right. Was that? You know, you mentioned earlier about the AKs. You know, there's a big issue in this country regarding gun control. And one of the things that I always talk about is that, look, the criminal's always going to get the guns. I mean, do you really believe that gun control is going to be the answer to some of this?
There are probably some reasonable gun control regulations. For example, laws against ex-cons, mentally disabled, or drug-addicted people from possessing guns. That seems like a pretty rational approach.
Right.
They should not have guns, because they do. They're likely to do something not too good, like commit a crime or whatever. That's been around a long time.
Right.
Ex-con with a gun and certain people being prohibited. But some of the regulations seem to be like kind of like feel good.
Right.
And don't accomplish anything. They're basically unenforceable. But some politician who's behind it feels better about himself. I think each one has to be looked at realistically in terms of, will this have a salutary effect in terms of public safety? Is it enforceable? Are there resources to enforce it? And quite frankly, there are not enough resources in the world to enforce all the gun regulations that are on the books right now.
Well, the Florida governor, they've done two things in Florida since this issue came up. The Florida governor has signed into law now that you got to be 21 years of age to be able to buy a rifle as opposed to 18. I think that's not a bad law.
That seems reasonable. That seems reasonable.
But he also just signed into law now where teachers can actually carry guns in the classroom. And that, to me, is not reasonable.
Yeah. That is an approach that's yet to be tested.
Right.
But if you have a active shooter scenario, let's say, where someone inside the school is armed and trained and then succeeds in taking down the assailant, there's going to go, oh, yeah, that was a great idea.
Right.
Or if you have someone who's in that situation and does a pretty crummy job and shoots innocent people.
Aren't they going to jail if they make a mistake and shoot somebody instantly?
Well, if they make a mistake, it could be excusable homicide.
Okay.
Or it could be manslaughter.
Right.
But nevertheless, the idea of having someone armed inside the school, that people point that and go, well, that didn't work.
Well, they already had an issue. They had an issue because one of the teachers left the gun in his drawer.
That's not good.
Unsecured.
Well, that's not good.
Well, he ended up getting...
you better hope you got a lot of trustworthy students.
Well, not to mention insurance, okay?
Because
you know you're going to be in trouble.
A lot of insurance.
So, yeah, so the issue about the AKAs, but the automatic weapons like that. The other issue is, in my opinion, how easy people can get those things and put them together on the Internet also. I mean, I have a friend of mine that literally built one off, got the parts off the Internet.
That's the world we live in.
That's the world that we live in. That's the world that we live in.
Yeah, some people build model airplanes, model boats, and some people build guns.
Yeah, well, there's Steve, I mean, that's Steve. Mr. Paddock, the Las Vegas shooter, he has 67. I mean, he didn't even have a criminal record. He wasn't supposedly, mentally
he
ill.
Had, and he had so much ammunition so many guns. And no, it's really, I mean, I'm glad he's not alive. He committed suicide. But I wish there would have been an opportunity to get inside his head.
Right.
What was going on with him? To kill that many people, just waste them?
For no apparent reason.
And go through, well, these people, they're there enjoying a concert.
Right.
And he went through some heavy planning to execute that thing.
Oh, yeah. They made that clear to us that day. It was amazing what this guy went through. I mean, he didn't plan that in 3 weeks.
No, he was no dummy. But he was very calculating, and he planned it out.
So tell me, on your second book, I know your second book is not out quite yet, correct?
Well, actually, it came out in paperback, comes out in paperback May 22nd.
Oh, okay. So
on Amazon.
Week. Okay.
And it's on Kindle. But the hardcover comes out in about a month.
Okay.
And it comes out in sort of different phases based upon publication and the printing schedule and availability, but it's been all the typical platforms. Eventually, it'll be an audio book that'll come out probably in a month or two. But no, we're the legit thing. This is not a vanity book. Bob and I know that the value of a book is if people read it or hear it.
Uh-huh.
Writing a book and then goes to the Library of Congress and sits there and gathers dust, that's no value. People don't read it. So it's out. The second book's out. And like I was telling you, it's really got the trend of officers being caught totally off guard, being killed before they get the gun out of their holster, or just being assassinated because they happen to be wearing a badge.
Yeah, well, killing anybody, badge or not, is sad that the lives that people take sometimes so callously.
Right. Oh, yeah.
It was amazing to me. But the first book that you wrote, so that one, they can get, you said, at Blue Lives.
They can go on the website, BlueLivesMatterBook.com. It's available on Amazon, all the platforms. Kindle, it's just the full array of ways to get in terms of written material.
Is this it for you, just two books, or are you going to go further than that?
No, actually, my partner and co-author and I, Bob Schern, we've already... we're pretty well along on a third book called Blue Lives Under Fire -- Shootouts, and we're documenting some of the more notorious shooting situations involving LAPD officers. This is LAPD's 150th anniversary this year.
Oh, really?
And we had so many shootings involving them. The North Hollywood shootout.
That's what I was getting ready to
say. The SLA shootout.
Oh, yeah, the SLA.
That happened in my patrol area back when I was working Newton, 54th and Compton. So those are two big shootouts, and there's individual shootouts, robberies broken up, things of that nature. Well, sometimes the suspect is killed, sometimes the officer is killed, sometimes they're both killed. But we're dedicating that one to LAPD on their 150th anniversary. Because they are notorious cases, and we had so many, we thought, okay, let's just do one book just with those. And then, unfortunately, we've identified scores of other murders of law enforcement officers, various scenarios that we could do a fourth book, a fifth book. We'll stop at some point, but we'd like to memorialize the deaths of these heroes.
Well, they are heroes, and I'll take a brief moment to also mention firefighters also.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, the firefighters out there doing a job. Some of them get shot sometimes by crazy people while they're trying to put out fires. You know, but the police officers, I think that this book is a very timely book, Steve.
Well, you know the story about law enforcement officers getting the Medal of Valor?
Right.
And firefighters getting the Medal of Valor. Police officers get the Medal of Valor for doing what firefighters do every day. And firefighters get the Medal of Valor for doing what police officers do every day.
Right. There you go. That's true.
It is true.
All right, Stephen, look, I want to thank you for coming out today. I really do appreciate that. And I'll tell my listeners, all right, you've been listening to Jim Potts on LA Talk Radio. It's time to close out the show, but let me remind you that you can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/JimPottsAuthor. Be sure to join me next week. If you like what you heard, spread the word. Until then, be aware, be vigilant, be safe, and be a reluctant victim. Thank you so much for tuning in today.
You're listening to Listen Up with Jim Potts, only on LA Talk Radio.